But after 1931, all this changed. Jazz proliferated. In fact, one of the most popular jazz men of the 1930s was a man named Alexander Zwassmann, who called himself Bob. Sounded a little jazzier, a little more American. And indeed, he played mostly American music. And as a result of his and other bands, Russians everywhere were listening to songs like The Man I Love, or In a Shanty in an Old Shanty Town, or a big hit in the 1930s, Chattanooga Choo Choo. The mood was fun, even amidst the terror. City parks all over the country organized big dances, the music usually being American, dances being the tango and the foxtrot and the rumba and the Boston waltz. And even outlasting jazz, which began to be seen as a little more dubious than at first by the later 1930s, outlasting its Soviet life became pervaded with light and romantic popular songs, Russian songs and gypsy songs and even some foreign songs. Or consider the cinema in the 1930s, the second half of the 1930s. To be sure, it had its share of political propaganda, though it was more about patriotism and heroism than actually building socialism by this period. But most popular and widely available, which under even a very controlled cultural regime, were films that focused on adventure and romance and above all, fun. In fact, comedies were extremely popular even during the days of the terror. The most popular, in fact, were musical comedies, all filled with sunny optimism and lively music. For example, a rather typical film was a film from 1934, but it continued to play throughout the late 30s, called Happy-Go-Lucky Guys. And the highlights included, for example, a cheery shepherd, who was the hero of this film, always smiling and joking and singing, who falls in love. An orchestra that he gets involved with, filled with white pianos and pearl-studded white double basses. Lots of very fun toe-tapping songs by a popular Russian Soviet jazz band that actually appeared in the film that never lets anything get it down. In fact, at one point, they all have a big fist fight just for fun, and they destroy all their instruments in the pleasure, and then realize somehow they have to play without instruments. That doesn't bother them either. They're always cheery and happy. And the whole film ends with a joyous finale at a congress of Stakhanovite workers in the Bolshoi Theater in Moscow. Pleasure and joy. In fact, even architecture tried to express the slogan that life has become more joyful, though in telling ways. First of all, there's constant construction during the 1930s, especially in the capital, Moscow. Government offices, apartment buildings for officials and Stakhanovites and others, still today considered the nicest, best built, most attractive buildings built in the country. They were meant to create spaces for people to have happy family lives. But also, there were extensive spaces built for the public to show that the state cares about them. Big squares and parks for the public to gather. Huge grand boulevards, set out with benches and lamps and nice plantings. An elegantly decorated subway system in Moscow. Theaters, clubs, headquarters of civic organizations. All were built to create a sense of pleasure and comfort. The metro, the subway in Moscow, is a rather typical and telling example. The first line was constructed in the mid-1930s, and it continued in later years. And in every one of these stations, especially those built under Stalin, we see the most elaborate and aesthetically traditional efforts to make the subway, where so many would go to get to work and travel about the city, as a symbol of a thriving and happy public life. Every station looked, and still looks, like an underground palace with walls and floors of marble, with elaborate, beautiful mosaics, with sculptures, with stained glass, with elegant chandeliers. Meanwhile, of course, most Muscovites, not the elite, and when they're not in public, lived in crowded communal apartments, three or five or more crowded into a room, sharing several families, sharing a single bathroom, a single kitchen, a single toilet. How can one make sense of all of this, of this combination of conservatism and continual ideological mobilization, this mixture of joy and terror. Some would argue this is all about being responsive to popular tastes, popular desires. This is what people wanted. Others have argued that this is part of the way the system controlled people. It gave them reasons to accept the absolute power of the new order. It masked reality. I consider a comment made a number of years later about one of the most popular musical comedies of the 1930s, a film called Circus, which showed how happy everyone was in Soviet life, and in particular, how all the various ethnic groups and nationalities got along so well, unlike, as the film suggests, in the racist U.S. This film, it was said by a Soviet who remembered it, helped stifle the shots that killed several generations of revolutionaries. It masked Stalin's ruthlessness and great Russian chauvinism, and it presented to the world the benign face of an idealistic socialist state on the march. Or one might ask, was this something still more complex and contradictory at its very essence? Next time, we'll see what happened in Soviet life as this contradictory political and social order confronted its greatest external challenge, the invasion from Nazi Germany.